Hey listeners, before I get into this episode, I have a quick ask to make. I started this podcast as a research project on how to be a top individual contributor in the product design space. My goal for the show was to learn what it takes to be an individual contributor that is doing amazing, impactful work that they love doing day in and day out and getting paid top dollar while they do it. Becoming that type of individual contributor is the ultimate job security. With close to 100 hours of interview recordings, this has naturally led to the creation of the short-form video articles that synthesize my learnings into 10-minute listens of actionable content. You might recognize these as my morning walk episodes or the hashtag shorts episodes. To my surprise, those episodes have been very well received and listeners have enjoyed the synthesis of what I've learned. This has led to the next chapter of my research project, which is beginning to synthesize what I've learned into a new newsletter called Thinking Out Loud About Design that you can subscribe to right now for free. Thinking Out Loud About Design is an email newsletter and podcast that basically contains all my synthesis for my long-form interviews. It's pure distilled learnings that you can apply to your career immediately. This content is for you if you are a couple years into your career and you're trying to make that move from mid-level to senior designer and senior designer to staff designer. I mainly focus on becoming high-performing individual contributors in the product design industry. A free subscription gives you full access to the newsletter, podcast episodes, and website. You won't have to worry about missing anything because every new edition of the newsletter goes directly into your inbox. So my ask is this. If you have gotten any value out of the way of product design, or if it's helped you in any way or someone you know, please subscribe to Thinking Out Loud About Design and get the distilled learnings on being a staff-level individual contributor. You can find a link to the newsletter in the show notes of every episode of this podcast and on my LinkedIn page. Just look up Caden Damiano. Thanks again for listening and supporting the way of product design. I wouldn't be doing this if you guys weren't listening. Now, on to the show. Welcome to the Way of Product Design. I'm your host, Caden Damiano. This podcast has one mission: help product designers generate massive value for their clients, their companies, and themselves so they can do the work they enjoy the most. We know design is valuable, but how can you unlock the true value of design in your work? To help with this, I interview top performers in design, product management, and engineering so you can understand what's valuable to your stakeholders, your bosses, and your customers. So enjoy this episode. Thanks for listening. My guest today is Adam Fry-Pierce, and he's the head of design ops at DocuSign. But when I was introduced to him, more notably, he was in charge of the Envisions Design Leadership Forum, where he is basically had contact with probably every designer you've ever admired on LinkedIn. So we're going to pick his brain on what he's learned from that experience today. But before we get started, Adam, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really excited for the conversation.
Adam, do you mind just introducing yourself to the listener real quick? Just your story, why you do what you do, and like how you got to where you are, and we'll go from there.
Okay, it's probably going to wind a little bit more than it should. But yeah, my start into the field was in advertising. It wasn't a great start. It was like all the bad rumors about advertising I feel like I experienced in a 9-month experience. It was the wrong firm, but it put a bad taste of the field in my mouth. So I went to its roots, the parts that I really liked, and that was design. Flipped on over to a firm in the early days and realized I was a terrible producer. It's really slow. But I was okay at working with people and some of the concepts. So if you fast forward a little bit, I eventually would open up my own agency with a partner. And we focused on all things design ops really before it was called design ops. Or if it was being called design ops, we didn't know about it. So it was like a lot of process work. We would do a whole lot of like org design and reorgs as teams scaled. Eventually, I would join Envision, working with the amazing team over there with Aaron Walter and Eli Woolery on design education at Envision, which was like a dream job. It was around 2017 when Envision was like really at their heyday. And they were just investing so much into the field. And they created this unit, the design education unit, which is really to help spread the best practices of design out to the masses. And we had a budget to do that. So that's where I was really helping behind the team on designbetter.co, which I believe is still up today. It's a place where there's a podcast and some great events, as well as a bunch of free books all on like design systems and leadership and so on and so forth. But another thing that we did is a whole lot of community efforts. And that's where the Design Leadership Forum came in. It's where just about 80 days ago at the time of this recording, I had departed Envision and gone back to OpsWork over at DocuSign. But that role with the Design Leadership Forum was pretty special. There's a whole story there, which we can get into. But by the end of it, I had the privilege of growing a community from nothing to about 3,200 design leaders. And like you said, a lot of just really smart and very talented people that I got to learn from. So I feel incredibly honored and privileged to have had that position.
Oh yeah, it sounds like a sweet gig. And I interviewed Drew Bridewell, who did that for a little bit.
Yeah.
But obviously the siren call of actual production work brought you back into actually practicing it.
It's hard. I don't know. I just missed having a single client in a lot of ways, if that makes sense. Definitely. Missed it back when I was doing the consulting stuff too. But yeah, I joined a great team. There's some really smart and talented folks here at DocuSign. That's awesome you had Drew on the show. I didn't realize he was here.
Yeah, he was in the last season. And yeah, just when he's like kicking off his next level UX, gave me access to like his mapping to learn course to really test it out. And he's just a high performance guy, just really infectious energy. Really love it. And I can only imagine just your ability to just meet with so many great like design leaders. So 3 years at the Design Leadership Forum, like, What was the thing that surprised you the most after talking to that many design managers?
Yeah. For anyone that's listening that doesn't know what this is, just go to designleadership.com and you'll see the first thing that you see is the mission, which is to advance the practice of design leadership. The idea behind this is it was a very private group. So you have to be invited in. Initially, it was a nomination process only. Now it's application. And we would review every single one of those applications. The criteria was pretty hardcore. Like you had to be leading a team building digital products, right? So the people that get in are people managers who most likely came from the route of a maker. But we had also quite a bit of folks who had migrated over from the product side of the house as well. So a whole lot of design leaders, most of which came from design and then some from product and engineering. And the thing that I really learned is like, everyone's just making it up. Everyone's winning. You have these like spectacular brands being represented who a lot of them had VP of design, chief design officer, these design authorities represented in the DLF. And I don't know, like in the first couple of conversations with almost everybody at that stature, like I found myself just writing a ton of notes and finding myself like incredibly impressed. But once we had gotten to a level of, I don't know, humanness, where it felt much more like this person's my neighbor rather than this industry name, it turns out that everyone just jumped into the fire in some way, shape, or form. If anybody knew what they were talking about, there was always an ellipsis that you would get to at some point in the story that really was a dot towards this question of, so what the hell do I do next? And that was the biggest goal for me as the community manager, is like, how can I create an environment where we get to that level quicker? So everybody can start to ask those questions and so that we can all just take down our masks and really just help grow together. Because that was why the DLF started in the first place, is like the field had grown in the last decade substantially. You had a lot of design leaders either earn the job because they were a senior designer or design manager, and then the industry arts or their business wanted to invest a ton of money into them, or they created a job for themselves and they were having to figure out essentially the same exact challenges all within their own companies, like all within their own silos. So the goal was, let's bring people together and we can like really just open up and talk to each other. So once we had gotten to that point, whether it was like an event, a dinner, a webinar, any sort of member experience, we would typically get to this section where it was like, oh yeah, I feel a lot better because those people that I was idolizing, which rightfully so, like incredibly experienced, have built some really cool stuff that I still respect to this day. I respect them even more because they humbly eventually admitted, I've just been figuring this out. I've just been winging it. And if you're really good, you're pretty good at figuring stuff out on the fly. So that, I don't know, for me, if I was listening to this, I wish somebody would have told me that a long time ago, because I still have a ton of imposter syndrome into my job now as a head of design ops. I had imposter syndrome just getting those people together and like curating a party. I just always thought to myself, like, who the hell am I? What did I do to deserve this seat with these folks? But yeah, I'd say like the best executives were just incredibly humble and open. And it's clear that they had looked in the mirror previously and said like, all right, I might have the direction down, but I certainly don't have all the answers. And that kind of mindset seemed to be following the ones that still to this day are the ones that I respect the most because they're just doing better work than most of their peers. So the whole punchline to the whole thing is if you meet somebody who says they have all the answers, they probably don't. And that's it. And that's okay. That's like the other thing is it's totally okay not to have all the answers.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's refreshing if they have like that. I think there's like a healthy level of imposter syndrome. Like I call it like healthy professional guilt. Like,
yeah,
just being like have it, just carrying a little bit of guilt. I could do better. I could probably put a little bit more into this, but it's just refreshing that I think the best design leaders probably just feel like a little bit of guilt that they're like, oh, like there's a lot of like luck involved. There's a lot of the mentors that are behind them that like help them become who they are. But at the same time, I think like the consistent variable is that they're just trying and just doing good, just striving to do good work. But from that finding though, what were like kind of like the common patterns, like from a tactical perspective? I'm actually looking at your summary of the Design Leadership Trends Report. Like what aspects of that report really stood out to you as you wrote that?
Yeah, right before the recording started, yes, another question too, which might help as a framer, like what is design leadership? The way that I frame it, I'm literally reading off a tweet that I pinned at the top of my profile, but about half a year ago, I wrote this. So the design leadership, like the job is really just to build self-managing teams and inspire them to own their solutions for customer problems. And the three responsibilities are vision, strategy, and execution, your coach, and your meta editing, meaning like the work that comes out, you might not be reviewing every single pixel necessarily. I hope you're not if you're dealing with a huge team, but there is like a meta edit function to that design leader, right? Most of your work is in the strategy, but at a tactical level, like there's like you're the ultimate pulse of the quality that your team is creating. The ways that you index are going to be highly towards like humanity, like the best executives, like I mentioned earlier, they're really humble. They also inspire through push and pull motions, right? Like they inspire through by example and the ways that they carry themselves into meetings, the way they carry themselves into work, the way they set and they have a healthy relationship to their jobs. They also index like incredibly highly towards business skills, which is a major topic in the last 2 years. There's a book on it by Ryan Rumsey called Business Thinking for Designers, which every single designer should be reading. But a design leader indexes highly towards humanity. They index highly towards business skills. They index highly towards influence, like the ability to lead top down, middle out, and bottom up. As if you're lucky to be the design leader that is influencing the CEO, you better believe that you're going to have to figure out a way to manage up. And of course, you have to be an expert in design and design thinking. So you asked, I think the other question was, now that we're lined up on the definition of a design leader, things I learned from the forum at a really tactical level, what did I take away? Super biased, all this is, but the big thing is that operations happens at a design team, especially enterprise, no matter what. And if there's not an operations leader, the design leader is inherently going to absorb those responsibilities, or a committee is going to absorb those responsibilities. And if that doesn't happen intentionally, what I found and through the stories of all the people in the DLF were that like, it just ends up becoming the design leader's job, which sucks up time. And it's important, right? Building an operational framework is incredibly important to scaling out a team. But again, if there's no ops leader, the design leader will absorb those responsibilities, which then limits them from being able to do the more strategic growth work that like such that you might find it like a highly mature organization where the design leader's time is heavily focused on creating a stronger design strategy arm for the organization. So that was like the biggest takeaway is like, if you're a design leader of an organization and you're growing quickly and you don't have an ops leader, that becomes your job. The other thing that I found out is there's how do I say this in like a way that doesn't sound super judgy? Found that like a lot of designers will get themselves into trouble if they don't ask for help. But going back to how we started this entire conversation is a lot of leaders think that they have to have all the answers, and they may not be willing to admit that they don't have all of those answers, which gets you frozen. Like you end up having to basically fake what the entire time that you're at a place, or you lose respect because you're not able to do the things you intend to do or set out to do, which doesn't do a good thing either for the person or for the entire function that they are tasked with leading. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Could you like expound a little bit on, I think like the respect aspect of it, like where, what behaviors are they doing? That is it like mismanaging expectations or predicting?
I think it's like, if you're not radically focused, that's apparent, right? It's super, not super easy. It's easier to react to problems around you than it is to proactively show up with questions that challenge your peers on really at any time, are we doing the right thing? And so from the design function, which is typically this, there's going to be those that argue with me, but ultimately it's the voice of the customer, right? Are we serving our users specifically? But depending on how you define the design function at the organization, some define that by the customer, some like to define it by all users, but it's that function's job to be able to defend the user all the way up to the C, and then create like a strategy as to how to create more value for those users. So if there's somebody that's not radically focused on that simple question, which is everything that we're doing, delivering as much value as possible to our users, and therefore by consequence, our business, that's where you find yourself in this like doom loop of reacting to problems that the business may want you to solve, but may not in the long run be the most useful way to use that function's time and energy. And so it ends up not actually advancing, let's say, user value or customer value. It ends up sometimes advancing like the business problems that you're, like the fires that you're putting out. But sometimes it's just a lot of organizations are bloated. There's like too many people there to solve the problems that an organization's trying to do. And so there's an incredible amount of like waste and teaming and stuff like that. So my challenge always out to design leaders, not from me, just from the stories that I've heard from those much more experienced than I, is are you defending that single question that ultimately defines the entire function? Or are you reacting to organizational hot potato? And that was a very long tail realization for me that never came out of a single event, where a lot of the tactical stuff that I learned over the last few years is, oh, we had a great discussion, we learned X, Y, and Z. That was just like an insight that slowly unraveled, and not one person ever said, but the masses ended up making it really clear. Yeah, the best, most effective leaders not only do all those things I mentioned earlier, and they index towards these certain traits, but they stay super focused on that single question of, remember why this function is here and why it's not just part of the product practice or part of the engineering practice. We are here to deliver as much value to the users and customers as possible. And by consequence, is a nice flywheel that delivers value back to the business. And that's okay for you maybe not to be super popular with your friends in product or engineering who may want you to do lower level design tasks. Yeah. So that's the big punchline there.
Yeah. Like I noticed kind of a pattern in my interviews and just in my personal network of designers, once they get into that leadership level, transitioning into a product role, like a product manager track, because there's the whole talk about how high can you go as a designer? Maybe it's VP if you're like really lucky, like chief design officer. And so they'll pivot over into product management because it's just, there's this, and I don't know if you see the same thing, but that the product manager job is starting to become more of owning. If you looked at the five steps of design thinking, empathize, define, they're starting to own those phases, like PMs, like they're doing interviews more. They're defining the problems so that they could prioritize which ones to work on more. I'm not saying that like designers shouldn't worry about that, but I think they're, it's like the PM's goal is to make sure that we're not working on bad ideas or like resourcing towards the wrong thing. But at the same time, like, I wonder how that works at a director of design, director of product relationship, when a director of design shouldn't be focusing on design ops. They should hire a design ops person to worry about that stuff. They should hire a design systems person to worry about
the design system, like the operationalized stuff, and they should be worrying about value delivery, which is what a PM leader would say is necessary, like their domain, right?
Yeah, I think it's all contextual, right? Like we're talking, yeah. I mean, all this stuff slides, right? Like, and I think that the best way that I like to make sense of it is by scope of complexity, which in the simplest two forms that you most often seen is like the complexity of the product or the complexity of your business. And complexity of the business, I like to define by like total headcount of the ecosystem which you're operating in. So a design director at 100,000 person company may not only have just like a tremendous, like more resources and budget than let's say like a design director at a company of let's say 10 people, but they're also going to likely have to do is be managing layers and layers potentially and layers of headcount. How we use director is so nebulous, right? So I don't know how to answer that question in a general sense, but like, yeah, there's function delineation that should be made in any way, shape, and form, regardless of your company. But in a small organization, a lot of this stuff can bleed into each other. So you don't see the function delineation really happening until you hit like an enterprise level, typically. And we've even seen like a few teams who, I don't know, this is like totally world according to Adam. I would think that eventually there's just going to be an experience team. There's going to be, that's where all customer facing experiences are housed underneath this singular function. Maybe that's too utopian. Maybe that's only going to exist in smaller companies, but it feels like that's where the industry is going. Like to your point, product and design right now already have quite a bit of crossover. And really the only places where I've seen like design really be able to do everything that that the practice can do for an organization is when product maybe isn't showing up in a way that it should. And that's sometimes by design. Like sometimes there's an organization that just grew, they were design first, the CEO or the founder came from the field of design, and they actually structure their organization to be design driven and customer driven. There are other organizations that like there was no strategy to it, but just as they were starting to build product, there happened to be a very strong design leader who was, to your point, like focusing more on the value exchange, like the end-to-end value exchange that maybe typically and historically product would have done. But in that same scenario, product perhaps just indexed more towards one aspect of product management and not the whole 360 function. So a lot of this stuff is, it's, I think, really easy to talk about in an academic sense, but I think the reality is that every single environment is going to be different and they're all made out of people, at least for now. And so it's just a big question of for those executives, which one historically has proven that they can add as much value as their practice will allow them to within the context of that particular environment. DocuSign, like I see how design is baked in into our product strategy, which is traditionally like a sales engineering driven organization, but design's influence here is far stronger. That would, to me, say, yeah, design is getting more resources over here. It's having more influence. I don't think that like from a functionality mapping standpoint, that if one is weak, that the other one's going to naturally take over. I think it takes like a certain type of leader to be able to fill those voids. Sorry, that was like incredibly tangential, but I think that like just an irk of mine is that a lot of people like to talk about like product-driven, engineering-driven, design-driven. It's really, it should all be customer-driven and then the rest of the function should inform. And I think that the quicker that all these different functions stop trying to have this debate of philosophically, which one of us is driving the company, probably the better. And I think eventually you're just going to get to this place where it's all about trying to create the best experience possible. And every function has its specialties to do that. This is probably a whole different conversation about what experience means and all that stuff. But yeah, I think design's always going to happen.
I think just what I'm getting out of it, and I'm starting to see it more, is that it really it just depends on the person at the wheel. And
yeah, 100%.
Like wouldn't you say that like a job of a... I think like a professional leader, like you even say product leader, engineering leader, even, but especially a design leader is like org design, depending on the business, depending on the constraints. Yeah. Wouldn't you say it's like org design's part of the job description as well? Like how your design team's structured, what kind of designers you're hiring?
Yeah. So before I just go off on my standpoint on org design, what's the question underneath it? Are you asking, is the way that you can extract your value as a design leader or that you can provide more value exchange from yourself to the business that you service, is it org design plays a piece? Because if that's the question, Absolutely. Because we were just saying a second ago, everything has to do about the environment in which you're operating. So if I'm a VP of design, but I'm over here in a silo, and I am just servicing, let's say, like the most traditionally known parts of design, visual, right? Then there's a whole chunk of the iceberg that I'm unable to lead my organization to maximize its value potential with UI, with research, with design strategy. And so that's where the entire idea of like design maturity comes into play, is like how receptive is the business to the function of design, and org design 100% play a role in your ability to funnel feedback up, to be able to like be involved at the right moments for, let's say, like your annual planning. Like, is design have a seat at the table? Everyone talks about that. Typically that table is an aspect of planning out a roadmap or where the business is going. Yeah, your org design has a huge piece of that. I think down at the release level and then all the way down to like the teaming level, this is where you'll see org design like plays its biggest role, right? It's not just in like the executive representation. And maybe where does design funnel into? Is it a funnel into product or engineering or directly into the CEO? But way down here is where you start to see the ramifications of a good org design. Peter Merholtz and Kristen Skinner famously wrote the book, Org Design for Design Orgs. And they talk about if you have an organization strategy that follows the customer journey, that you're naturally going to remove a whole lot of the friction that might come out in like a broken customer experience. There's been a lot of truncated quotes that have come out of that by like really smart people on Twitter and stuff ever since. But like the whole punch into that is if your org has like tension built into it or silos built into it, that's going to manifest into the overall customer experience. It's why one screen has a totally different experience than another. It's typically because the teams were not talking to each other. And that's not necessarily the design leader's fault. That's much more of a larger symptom of misalignment throughout an organization. What a design leader can do, though, if there is broken org design, is to push that point through. Going back to the original charter of why, what the design leader is there to do, answer that question: are we delivering as much value as possible? If they have realized as much of the function's value as they possibly can within the org layout, or let's say they get several sigmas in. Let's say like on a crazy world that there are six sigmas of effectiveness in value realization for that particular org setup, then it would be the design leader's job and responsibility to challenge the rest of the business to say, the only way that we are going to get more value to our customers is if we change our org setup. That's super academic and theoretical. There's no way that in that world that I just described, that org design is the only thing to do to increase value, but that would be the design leader's responsibility, right? As a challenge. It might not be in their control to tell the product team how to lay out all their product teams, but they certainly should be starting that conversation and challenging their peers to have that conversation if they're not happy.
And then hopefully if it's a healthy interaction, like working with the product and engineering teams to build out like the squads and the problem spaces they're focusing on. And it's like a joint designed artifact. I think like any product, right? Like the PM, engineer, designer, like that kind of like that squad model, like it's whatever the output is, it's a team effort. And so hopefully they have a good enough relationship with their cross-functional partners. But it does sound like a lot of the outcomes that makes a design leader probably like the reason they earn the big bucks is that they have a strong influence in different parts of the organization to generate those outcomes, like a better org structure or a better process or like better expectations. And you mentioned before this interview, something you learned called exec speak. Could you explain like what that is, just to make sure that I'm thinking the same thing before I ask a bunch of questions about it?
It's just a term that like Andy LaMonica is a friend of mine and a coach that I had hired at some point. And I remember it was a compliment that I gave him and it didn't mean to turn it into a term. Like, you're really good at exec speak. And he laughed at me. He's like, what is that? I was like, it sounds like you've been an executive at like a Fortune 10. He brands himself as a design and a brand leader. And he's also has all these incredible certificates, like professional level coaching. But it was also really clear, like he came out, he worked at GE for years underneath, I think it's Comstock or Linda, perhaps one of the CMOs there. And so I think like at that level of a public organization, it's a conglomerate, you're going to naturally shift into communicating the way that these C-suiters do at those organizations. I haven't seen a whole lot of design leaders pull this off at Andy level, which, by the way, if anyone listening to this is interested in like up-leveling, go to Andy. It's like the best money I've ever spent. But the exec speak thing is just, it's the general vibe of, does this person seem, they, if I got their business card, that it would have a C in front of it. And it's that kind of a thing. Now, that feels gross to say, because I don't think that all status should be delineated by the letter that's in front of your name, whether it's a V or a C. Titles are incredibly misleading. And you know, plenty of CEOs that are like, you would never know, but like they're killing it in like their mind. And they're like, so I want to be really clear when I say like exec speak, I put it within the context of like conglomerate, like Fortune 10, clearly working at like a public organization, probably had their fair share of like public interviews. And there's like that flavor of design executive that I think very few people in the world can be, because there's just not that many spots. There's not that many, not every Fortune 500 company has a CDO, for example. I don't even know how percentage it is. I only know, gosh, out of the thousands of members that were in the DLF, I think like less than 50 were chief design officers. And we had a huge representation in the Fortune 500. So I wouldn't say that you have to have this talk in order to make it. But if you're at a public-facing company, if you're a conglomerate, there's just like a certain vibe that comes along with executives. And I started to pick up what that was. Yeah, it's all related to what we were saying earlier. And it's really just like the business language. Like, how articulate are you? What questions do you bring to the meetings? And the general like sniff test is, if I'm leaving a meeting, who was the person that asked the most challenging questions? And not just like talking for the sake of talking or filling up space with their ideas. Who was challenging the group to be better? Who were the 10X colleagues that were in the room? That, you know, if I spend a year with, I'm going to be 10 times the version of myself, because they brought that style, that lens, and then they knew how to communicate it through exec speak, if that's what we're calling it.
Yeah. It sounds like people that like have that kind of executive presence, we'll call it, are just really good at the art of the question, to make us like question our inputs rather than telling us like, we should do this or it. Yeah. And you're like the fifth person that's brought that up. Oh, they just asked the most challenging questions. That's such an interesting indicator.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I feel like in some cases, if you're just a super curious person, like you can do tremendously rest of your life if you just like are unapologetically asking like really hard questions to the group. And I know, I'm sure you've been there. I know I have. And I'm sure the listeners have like been in a room where we all vibed with the product team or whatever, whoever is our particular team. Okay, great. Like we're about to ship it. And if there's this general sense of, okay, it's good enough, but it could be better. And then they ask that like super uncomfortable question. Does this really meet our standards? Like, you're not a popular person, but you're making everybody better. So like it's asking good questions, but it's also knowing like when to ask them and just being comfortable with it, not like carrying that with you. I am somebody who's incredibly sensitive to what other people think around me. So I'm really aware with the relationship of asking tough questions does not equal popularity, right? Like It might equal better, but you might be incredibly unpopular as a result. And so like, you just have to balance those two things.
Can you think of a really good, like a story time, like a really good question where you were settling on the value and then someone said, oh, what about this? Or do we think about this? And you're like, oh,
yeah, I can tell you when we asked and then we just decided to say, screw it. And it just wasn't the best thing. So I'll give you a great. So when I mentioned that I had a consultancy, there was this stage in my life where there was like the entrepreneurship stage. Started with the agency and then it was a conference company. And then like I went way over the line and got involved with a restaurant. Like, whoa. But the conference company, we did not think was going to be big. We were doing it as almost like a selfish way just for us to stay plugged in with people, because the consulting side was so narrow. It's like we were a shop of three people, so we could only service so many companies. It was, you know, less than five pretty much throughout the year. But the conference company would allow us to stay in touch and to meet people without having to go pay for it. So it was like a very much selfish need. We did not have any ambitions for it to be a profitable venture, and it ended up being the most profitable venture. I'll never forget, we're all sitting there and we're trading ideas and names. And we should have done like a proper brand exercise, proper naming exercise, all of that. And we didn't. And somebody was like, are we sure we want this to be the name? And we all looked around and we're like, yeah, it's not going to be big. And so boom, it was all locked. It was called Exchange. And it was just like a total missed opportunity. Actually, we called it Fulcrum Exchange, which Fulcrum was the name of our agency. Exchange was the name of the conference. And it just was like, it was such a mouthful. And it ended up being such a problem that like I kept going back and been like, wow, I really wish that we would have just listened a little bit to Matt was his name when he was like, are we sure that we want to? And it was just one of those things, like so easy to brush under the rug, and it ended up becoming not like a TED style conference, but it was fairly well known at its time. And it was like, oh, you're the Fulcrum Exchange guy. And I remember like one of the first questions I always came up was like, what's up with the name? So I had to live with that. Just, yeah, I should have slowed down and I should have asked questions. And there's plenty of other less talkable stories for like products that never shipped that we've definitely been part of. There's a lot of wasted time and energy and everything just because people were okay with substandards, and come shipping time, yeah, we didn't challenge each other enough. And so the work never saw the light of day and we all wasted a bunch of time and energy. So yeah, I've been through that dance more times than I'd like to admit, but the strong on the other side is a result for sure.
Yeah. So it's not like challenging for the sake of challenging. It's like having that gut feeling and knowing that like, the consensus of the room is just move forward, and then just being willing to be like, yeah, are we sure we like want to do it this way? Or yeah, just ask a question that kind of elicits like the response of someone actually gives a well-meaning rationale and you're like, oh, okay, now I understand. Because sometimes it like makes sense, but
yeah, I feel like designers, sometimes we can forget like the way that we're educated. And I say we, I didn't go through design school. Like I went to school for advertising, which is essentially like a sexy psych degree. Like the design thinking practice is you have all the tools there to be the most valuable person in the room at any given time. Just who are we designing for? What's the goal? What are the problems that we're trying to solve for? What's the ideal outcome and how are we measuring it? Those are the four things that carry with you throughout the rest of your career. At the executive level, that's no different, right? Like those four questions can probably protect somebody if they feel like they're like a little over the water, or maybe they bit off more than they can chew. And it's like day five of a new job. And like, oh my gosh, what did I get into? It's like those questions, those are the right questions to always be asking, or like derivatives of them. The five whys are other ones. So like the entire design thinking toolbox, like everything there for somebody to be successful, as long as they remember not to overcomplicate it and come back down to those core tools.
What concerned you? Like, what's something that you learned that concerned you as you spent time in the design leadership forum?
I need to clarify the question. I could take this route of as an Envision employee. I could take it the route of like, trends across leadership, or
no. I think it can be broad, but I think just think of it as you being a thought leader, not as like an employee of a company or anything like that, but something that like worried you about like best practices or beliefs. And there's no right answer. It's just your answer that I'm looking for.
Something that concerned me as I was learning about it. I have never thought about this, and there's nothing that's like popping up. Maybe. Okay. Actually, yeah, there's a few. So yeah, never mind. Boom. Right there. The general dialogue. And I realize like there's two white men having this conversation right now. I mean, it took me a long time to get like comfortable with this, but where I'm going with this field feels like it's driven by people that look and sound like us. I made a mistake early on that looking back, I would have never thought that it was a mistake, but now having been through it, it's like, oh yeah, whoops. When we started the DLF, there was 12 founding members balanced on men and women. There's, it was 6 and 6, or actually might have even been 7-5 women to men. There's different backgrounds. Geographically, it wasn't super diverse because it started in San Francisco. So it was obviously like very tech heavy, like a lot of brands that people knew about, which now I can say like Uber, you know, Lyft, a bunch of other great companies were there, not just tech car companies. But anyway, what we did is we had no DEI like goals at all with the community. We just said, let this be organic. If there's somebody that fits the criteria, which is you're leading a team who's building digital products at the director level or above, or can responsibilities, we would let you in based on those criteria. And after time, it was like, oh, there's a lot of white dudes here. Like there's a lot of white dudes here. And that became problematic because what happened is and there's also a lot of tech represented here, which it's in the constraints of membership building digital products. But so what we end up seeing is like the programming was always fairly open. Let's just go ahead and get people together that have a similar challenge or in a similar industry, and we'll talk about whatever's pressing. Sometimes we would prescribe the topic, but oftentimes we let the group like self-select. And a lot of the topics that ended up coming out for a long time had nothing to do with diversity or like growing a diverse team. And so there was blinders on in a lot of ways. And so something that was concerning was like, what do we do about this? And talking about this through the lens of like community growth, but it's much bigger than that. The thing that I got out of it is like, even a lot of white men in the group, like didn't necessarily want to have this conversation about like, should we create transparency in our pay policies to make sure that we can create like equitable areas? Because there might be a woman who's making less than a man, and the only person that knows that is the HR individual as well as like management. So a great way to solve that is create transparency policies for pay. Another way to grow a balanced team is to state loudly and very publicly so that your peers can keep you accountable towards growing your team. And why is this important? There might be people that are like, oh man, no, that's just a talking point or whatever, but allowing the teams to create better products, right? Like just across the board, especially if you have a super wide audience funnel, it's really easy for us to bring our biases into leading our teams. And that influences how the makers are actually building the products. So diffusing those biases as much as possible so that you can create a more balanced perspective to create better products and better experiences. It's a good thing for your customer. It's a good thing for your business. It's a good thing for your career. And so there wasn't like a whole lot of conversation happening organically around DEI in general, as far from a really intentional standpoint, for a long time. And that was very recent, in the last like maybe 6 months, where that topic started to surface. And we actually created the space so that we could have those conversations. But I would say that was concerning. It's probably not concerning now. Like the topic itself is getting a lot of attention. The reality of like where DEI is at a product level, as well as at a culture level for an organization, still have tons of work, but we're finding that more and more leaders are being receptive to the topic, which is really promising, right? Because a few years ago, if you were outside of some of the major cities like San Francisco or New York or Seattle or London, I'm not sure if this was in the spotlight. I will also say that just a few weeks ago, I'm talking to, I won't even say the country, but like a group of design leaders outside of the States. And I brought up this question of how many of you are dealing with like pay transparency policies for diversity, inclusion, building your team? Are there inclusive design practices that you're leading? And basically everyone laughed at me and like, that's an American problem. I was like, really? And, oh yeah. That's an American thing. Like we don't have to deal with that here. And I just felt super uncomfortable. I was like, I think you do. Like, I think that you should, for all the reasons I previously stated, which I communicated to them. It's like, if you don't care about it, you'll look like a rock star because you're going to make your company more money and you're going to make customers happier, but you should care about it. Like you should definitely care about it. And that's where the conversation was. Yeah. Full circle. That was a little concerning how we weren't having conversations about that initially. Fast forwarding to now where it is in the spotlight, folks are talking about it. Perhaps we might forget that I come from this place of seeing this lens of mostly the Americas and Europe. There are other places in the world that design leaders, this just isn't something they're talking about.
Wow. I'm glad you brought that up, because that was a recent experience I had with the podcast. It was very similar. Start it. Oh, let's just do it organically. It'll be a nomination process, right? And I do like a custom thumbnail for every episode. And I laid it all out and I'm like, was proud of it. I'm like, oh, this looks cool. It shows like a bunch of faces, and I screenshot it, posted it on LinkedIn. And then very quickly, everyone's, oh, there's a lot of white people. And if you like say like San Francisco is not like geographically prevents like diversity. Like I'm from Utah. There's not a lot of people of color that, and you could even, so I was just like, I made a goal, not as a, oh, I need to like bring more people of color on, but I was like, oh, I need to change the network hubs I'm reaching out to.
Yeah, man.
Recommendations. It's
so important. And I have made the mistake of not being more intentional about it in the past from a like building out my team standpoint to building out the community and all the way to like now from a product standpoint, it's everywhere. And it's so important. Like that's the reality is unless we intentionally try to your point, build out those pathways, we're going to naturally gravitate towards the ones that we've already been down before because there's mm-hmm. less friction there. Like it's easier. Like I don't need to clear cut all the bushes that are like on this path over here because this one is paved. It's easier, but it's not better from any sense of the word. It's something that's top of mind for me now. And the stories that surface out of the DLF, they're just a great reminder.
Yeah.
But I'm glad to hear that I wasn't alone here.
Oh, I was really embarrassed, but like my first gut reaction was like, I just don't know. For example, I don't know a lot of like Black designers, so I don't know who to talk to. So I flipped the script on them and I'm like, okay, who should I talk to?
Yep.
And some people were like, silence. And I'm like, oh, you just wanted to call me out. But there's other great people that they're just like, oh yeah, no, you can talk to this. And it just opened up like this whole network. And it wasn't because of like a quota. I was just recommended more people that happened to be Black or from a person of color. And it was just really fun and like eye opening because it was just, it was the same type of conversation. There wasn't any like friction there. And it led to a more diverse perspective on how to get our jobs done well.
Yeah. And the other cool thing too, is that if you find, at least this was my experience, I found that when I've invited others that typically aren't, let's say like historically known to be in, let's say a leadership role, that there's a lot more adversity that comes out of their story that is so helpful for everybody who's listening to that story. Because I think that anybody who's had to pave their own path, for as an example, they're going to be able to extract a little bit more of those like tactical questions on pathing for everybody, regardless of if like myself, I've had I'm incredibly grateful for the pathway that I've had growing up in here, this country of all countries, on the West Coast of all states that I could be in one of the tech hubs in Seattle. It's like, how lucky did I get? And even that, like I found myself so lost over the last, you know, 15 years that I've been doing this. I can only imagine how much more difficult that gets for every barrier of entry that you put into it. You mentioned you're in Utah, right? That's more difficult to find your way. Just a few years ago, you would have had to uproot and go work out of San Francisco if you wanted to work for any of the major tech companies. But yeah, every single other layer that you add to it, right? Like maybe look and sound a little bit different than what everyone's expecting. You probably had to work harder. So I'm curious, like, how did you get past those barriers? I think there's so many fascinating stories in there and that we can all just learn from. That's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah, well, that's really good. So yeah, we're coming up on time. I'll just add like one more thing. Like, it's also like the problems they're interested in solving too. Like Terrell Cobb, he was like season finale of season 4. And he talked about doing design thinking exercises in like less privileged communities in Texas. In the Dallas area, and they're like ideating like different like solutions for stuff. And one of the kids was like, came up with a solution to prevent kids from getting hit by cars on the streets. Cause he had a friend that got hit by a car because the streets aren't as safe. There might not be as much like signage or zoning that prevents like high traffic, which is like characteristic of a safer neighborhood. And it was just wild to think that, yeah, a lot of the problems they want to do, like another example is like Safe Boda, which is a Ugandan tech company. And it was started by white Europeans who went there and saw like the motorcycle taxis. And they're like, ooh, this is like really sketchy. This isn't safe. But then they found out like the job to be done was, it was more of a status thing for the Ugandans. They didn't care about safety as much. It was a different solution.
Interesting.
Yeah. Really interesting. And then also, if you can imagine that they're interested in different problems, they're probably going to bring like different executions to what your company's trying to solve too.
Yeah, just it goes back to that really simple idea, like balanced perspective is likely more valuable. There's this other thing too that I've learned. I've tried to be, most of this comes from being raised like as a middle child Catholic, like so many pleases and thank yous and like never feeling like I was like in the right place or whatever. But over time, is that idea was one of the first ones that an early mentor had given to me, try and create as much balanced perspective as possible. And she was incredibly commercial, but she was like, there's just more money there. It's like, you will end up doing better for the business and customers with balanced perspective. The altruistic message underneath it was always there, but it was always through the lens of like commercial. So as I found myself in more positions of influence and ability to like lead teams, the thing that I've learned is there's also a Goldilocks zone of like how much inclusion you can do. Like I used to think that we can do like massive sprints and like huge kickoffs and retros. And yes, balanced perspective for sure, but people work better in certain sizes of groups depending on what the problem that you're trying to solve. But yes, like everything in life, everything is, at least everything that humans make, everything is designed, which means that there is an intent and a central problem that you're trying to solve for. And inherently, there's going to be things that don't get attention. The DLF is a great example of this. Like, it was for design directors and above and not for everybody else. There's a ton of judgment that can come out of that, right? Like people saying, oh, you should do this, that, and the other. And they're right. And there are associations that speak to those things. But what we could do is take the lens of just from a DEI and like a human fabric standpoint is to create probably more markers that would allow us to have a balanced perspective within the community. And as I like ever grow teams again, like a budget for headcount, it's 100% going to be something that I take in, but it's going to go way beyond just, you know, what I look and sound like. It's, what's your background? What did you study? Do you like to travel? On an Enneagram, are you a complementary number to what I am, or Myers-Briggs, whatever your leadership personality? What I always like to think of as balanced perspective is so much more than what we look and sound like. It's how do we think and what makes us. Everyone's unique and yeah, that's your story.
So. And Lee Chikowski talks about that, like you are the experiences you have. So it's pulling, he knows better than anyone, like just uproot, selling his house, uprooting his family, going to Intuit in Europe and
yeah,
living in London. And then supposed to have that European and working in Europe experience, then COVID hit, poor guy. But yeah, such a great thought. Adam, do you have any like closing thoughts before we wrap this up?
No, just I would say for anybody that's interested in design leadership, just remember it, not to overcomplicate it. It goes back down to those core fundamental functions that you're trying to deal with as a designer, and it just rises with you as a people leader. And having like storytelling and the impact that you're always providing top of mind is like how you're telling your story, making sure that everything that you are doing from an outcomes perspective is measured, and then creating yourself, like I like to lead with principles first, right? First principles. If you have yourself a set of first principles, as well as those questions to lean back on, and as long as you're fairly personable, it's hard to think that you can mess it up because no one really has it figured out. We're all winging it. So I think you'll be just fine.
Thanks so much, Adam, for coming on the show.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks again for listening to The Way of Product Design. One quick favor. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your network, your friends, and hit that subscribe button on the show wherever you're listening to it. Thanks again for listening to the show. And I'm really excited to bring more awesome interviews and content your way. So keep listening. You won't be disappointed.